This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, leaving and loving Afghanistan. On August 15, Kabul fell. That night, Taliban fighters were inside the presidential palace. You can see them roam around the corridors and walk into beautiful rooms with wood-covered walls, marble floors, and crystal chandeliers, or stop for a selfie behind the desk of President Ashraf Ghani, who had fled earlier that day in a helicopter. At a press conference, a Taliban spokesperson promised that those who had resisted them would be forgiven and that women's rights would be respected. He even made a point of taking a few questions from female journalists. But the reality outside the press room was different. Afghan women were told not to go to work, for now, because it was too dangerous, a tactic the Taliban had used the last time they were in power, to keep women in the house indefinitely. And a rumor went around that Taliban fighters were knocking on doors to find people who had worked with the Americans. People scrambled to get out. Some fled over land to Iran, Turkey, or Pakistan. Others hoped to make it to the airport, past the checkpoints, only to stand for hours or sometimes days outside the gates in the scorching heat, with nothing but the water or food they'd managed to carry. Past Thursday, this was 11 days after Kabul fell, I talked to an Afghan-American poet, essayist, and scholar, Zora Said. She left Afghanistan when she was just 1 year old, ahead of the Soviet invasion, and she came to Brooklyn, New York, where she now lives with her family. And like many people in the diaspora, she's spent the past week and a half frantically trying to get people out. So how has your morning been?
Oh, it's good. They just had an explosion by the airport and we had friends there, but luckily they got out. So they were waiting right there.
They're waiting where?
Right by the explosion area. Mm-hmm. And they turned back because they finally gave up. They're like, never mind. We're not. They waited 48 hours in front of an airport with a baby.
And do you know when people wait like that, like especially with a baby, like how do you sleep? How do you go to the bathroom? How do you do anything like that? Do you know?
It's a horrible situation. It's inhumane. The soldiers don't let you move. So if you're standing and waiting there, they could even tell you to stand in water. And they did, which is what happened in this situation. Yeah. And then I think they just got fed up and turned around and that worked out in their favor. I was actually, I had a work meeting, so I was just getting it as I was having this work meeting, and it was really intense, but I'm glad everyone was safe, so.
How do you stay in contact with people? I mean, are cell phones just working? Is the network up, or how does that work?
So it's usually through relations, so I'll be in touch with a family member who's in the diaspora, and then they'll get in touch with, I don't know how they're in touch with, so it's either WhatsApp, Viber, or their regular phone. They'll just call on landlines. But WhatsApp seems to be the main form of communication. Mm-hmm. And even the military, when they inform them of evacuations, it's through WhatsApp encrypted messages. So, yeah. I think the diaspora has become like an expert one in immigration, visa applications, refugee things, everything. We've suddenly like come together on, again, also things like WhatsApp and Signal to figure out ways to help evacuate. And we're all working out of our kitchens and our little tables and our living room couches to kind of do something. Mm. It's probably been the best support system, the groups that we're forming. And it's really international. So we have friends in London, friends in Australia, Canada, and the U.S. It's kind of like a cowboy mission for some to get some out, where they're rescued and put on a plane, and you know they kind of have their papers, but halfway. In other ways, it's more organized through like State Department and going through all the channels and the paperwork, and you know, paying all the processing fees. So it's been, I don't think I've ever felt this kind of intensity, urgency, and fear and joy and togetherness. So there's the the irresponsibility of governments, and then suddenly you have just regular people coming together and being, you know, like almost like government officials, clerking, getting papers done, getting people connected, sharing resources. It's like when those governments fail us, it's the everyday regular people. And it's, you know, it's not just like Afghan diaspora doing this. It's everyone. Like you have veterans who cared, you have like housewives, you have journalists, you have, everyone has a friend, a connection, or empathy to help. We're all strangers helping one another. It's not like I knew anyone beforehand. Yeah. I had a very emotional voice note yesterday through WhatsApp by a journalist I've never met. So she's in London and I'm in New York. We've been working together and getting women in danger out. And the message is really simple. And we're both crying because there was a big shuffle yesterday, a big scramble. And they said, this is the only time Afghan nationals could get out. And then they just started shutting doors. So a lot of people are stranded, even citizens of other countries, even like, say, for the U.S. green card holders were like left behind. And everyone was just crying. We were all devastated because so many people were trying to help and were filling out forms where they trust us with their passports and their information. And when you can't follow through, it's just this great pain and helplessness and powerlessness. But to share that, and she shared that with me, she said, we stay committed and we continue to help these people. We're not going to abandon them the way, you know, other nations abandon people. And I was just so moved by that, that kind of, again, it's when governments fail, it's like the human heart, the human soul is what really shines and comes together. So I think that's what's been really powerful for me.
And have you been able to get anybody on a plane? Has there been a success story that you have witnessed?
Yes, there is. Yeah, there is. And that's been probably the best experience. But yeah, she's in, I think she's in California or Virginia. I don't know which one. I don't really get too much information about afterwards, but I did get a chance to talk to her yesterday, and you know, she speaks English. She's a journalist. So it was really nice to hear her voice, put a voice to the passport photo and the ID number, and to talk a little bit. And she's working, you know, it was a State Department project for endangered women. So she's going to go through the process, but she's also helping and already working to get others out, activists, journalists, writers, you know, that the endangered groups out. I mean, I don't have a large number of friends and trying to get out. But I figure if I concentrate on a very small number, I can, you know, see it through. That's all I can really do. That's all I have the power. I'm just, you know, I'm just a teacher. I'm just a writer. I'm not going to be able to do much more, but it's just incredible. Yeah.
And what kind of language skills do you need in order to be a part of this effort? I mean, you speak Uzbek. Do you speak Dari too? Or
yes, I do. Well, I don't need any. I'm just one cog in the whole clerical process. So I fill out the visa forms. So I need to just know English. And then I have another friend. And this is the changes. They just translate it for me. So I wouldn't be able to read it. I'm not so good at the reading. But yeah, so it's just like, again, we're all like just one little tiny little pieces in this trail of paper that's getting people out. And then the difficult part, the part where it's actually all based on the courage of the person leaving, is getting through those gates, getting to the airport. That's the scary part.
Yeah.
I've never been to Kabul. I wouldn't even know where to send anyone. So, and the logistics of actually getting people out, I don't know anything about those. I just know how to type in data, which is kind of what I was doing when I was, when we were applying for our own immigration things. So it's, it is a repeat of that, but with much more urgency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And are your parents still alive?
Yes.
How are they experiencing this? Because they also, I mean, you were too small when you immigrated to the United States, but they have their own immigration experiences and memories. How is it for them to watch such an exodus again?
Yeah, well, I think it's very painful. Of course, we are refugees. Every generation is a refugee in our family history from originally newly formed Uzbekistan, or which was once Turkestan, to India, to Afghanistan. So it's
a lot of journeys to Saudi Arabia, to the US. So
for our family history personally, it's every generation has that kind of story of fleeing, leaving things behind, leaving the familiar, rebuilding. So we have around 7 languages within my family. So
wow.
So it's different. I think for me in particular, it's a different. We were refugees. My grandparents, great grandparents were refugees.
I'm wondering what you have from, you know, keepsakes, family heirlooms, photographs, like if you have anything at all, or has everyone always just have to leave in a hurry, and did nobody really have a chance to take things?
Well, we do have things, yeah. A lot of it is, we have a very small family at this point because my grandfather was 18 and his whole family had been massacred. So he had to flee with his baby brother through Kazakhstan to Ila in China, in the Uyghur areas. Mm-hmm. So we're also very mixed. We're Uyghur, Kipchak, Uzbek. But we do have very important heirlooms. Like from my Uyghur grandmother, we have a lot of white jade because she's from Khotan, which is all white jade areas. There's some long history. We come from an old family, so there's a lot of like old swords and things and griffins, and I don't know what they are, but that's always been fascinating to have. Photographs, of course. So not in the same sense as refugees now, which who are leaving with a backpack and told within an hour to sort of leave. So that would be a different experience completely. So I haven't had the experience, but you still feel, right?
Yeah. And your grandmother is Uyghur, you said.
Yes.
So another culture that is being violently erased at the moment.
Yes, and that's one of the languages I was learning as a way to preserve, because that's, the writing is being taken away and it's they're being punished for reading and writing in Uyghur. So for me, learning it was a way to kind of keep that tradition, that language alive.
Oh, and how do you learn that? I mean, are there courses or do you just know someone?
Yeah, a
or?
Friend teaches it. So I've been taking it with her, which is, she's an asylum seeker in DC. So she teaches Uyghur language classes, Aynur. So that's been really a nice gift.
There's a poem in your anthology, One Story, 30 Stories, where you write about this tapestry of Turkic languages that you kind of grew up speaking and hearing and sharing with the kids on the block in Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn, where you grew up.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Neptune Avenue. And I was just wondering if you can introduce it a little bit before you read it.
Yeah, so Sheepshead Bay, Brighton Beach was a large Uzbek Afghan community. It's Sheepshead Bay in general has been a very Turkic community since the 1960s, maybe 50s with the Tatars who came first, and then the Turks, and then the Uzbek Afghans, and then the Uzbeks. And now it's known as like
Little Samarkand. So it's kind of
funny that many, now it's mostly Tajik and Uzbeks. It's just these layers of Turkic migration that happened because of the closeness of language and foods and things we can eat. So
that the Neptune Avenue story is just based on growing up in the 80s in Brooklyn and
having all these cousins to play with, and whether they were really related or not, it's not clear if they were blood relations, right. But they were cousins. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so should I read? Or
yes, please.
Okay. So Neptune Avenue. On the streets of Brighton Beach, when we swing from fire escapes and jump on the hoods of cars, we own the block through the force of our play and the clicking and clacking of our tongues. Ah, the power of 10 children with their own language. It's enough. We are our own gang, self-sufficient when we are not bound to school. We exist happily on fragmented languages, the breadcrumb of slang from the many streets we grew up in, Kabul, Mazar, Jalalabad, Riyadh, Jeddah, and Brooklyn. Our language is the roof we carry over our heads, even when we are separated into different classes at school. If only mothers would let us be, we'd rather stretch our weekends and wrap it across the belly of the year. We'd rather dangle out every day on the fire escapes of the second floor mosque, spill the khutbah onto the sweating concrete by opening the windows wide, then jump onto the sidewalk, align our velvet prayer mats next to parked cars, and play imam and ummah as passerbys gawk at the magic of our flying carpets, and at 1 5-year-old brother, serious-faced, hand over ear, singing out the call to prayer with a sugar-sweet throat. We quit school. We quit suspecting lunch ladies of slipping in slivers of swine while we aren't looking. We are willing to live within the bubble of cousins, praying or gossiping in wild tongue flips as neighbor children stare in awe. When their mouths ache from the strain of our language, we blow kisses at them. We have won another battle of the streets, but still our mothers want us to clean our rooms and fathers demand our report cards. What choice had we? In the day, our mothers are the sun, and at night, our fathers. To mark the celestial transition, mothers sit in the kitchen an hour before fathers come home. They hide behind the steam of cooking while we children stand in line with colorful plastic combs in hand, waiting our turn by the only mirror we can reach on our own. Later, we visit them to approve us and prepare our welcome for fathers. Our tough skins are for the block and for the neighbors. At home, we are forever courting our parents with neatly combed hair, sweet voices, trim nails, and memorized prayers. We are the constellation. We shine each time they smile at us.
Thank you.
Nice. I haven't read that in a while.
It's such a sweet, mischievous poem. So when you are living in Brooklyn, growing up in Brooklyn, far away from the countries of your parents, of your grandparents, how do you keep a tether to your culture?
Well, I don't know if my culture is flying away. I think it's inside me. I mean, I cook. That's part of, you know, I guess a tethering to culture. I do make all the traditional foods, like, you know, just cooking palau and mantu, dumplings and things like that. I'm terrible at making noodles, hand-pulled noodles. They come out like sausages, but everything else I'm pretty good at. Hormas and fresh bread. And so these things I feel like are the ones that really ground us. Rituals, right? Like, praying in the morning is a really grounding ritual for me. It kind of anchors everything. And the rituals of holidays, Nowruz, and New Year in spring, and ritual of, like, you know, how to celebrate beginnings, how to clear the house of negativity, those kind of rituals as well, folk rituals.
Oh, wait, tell me about those. I haven't heard about those. I've heard of Nowruz, but I have not heard of clearing the house of baggage, let's say.
What is that? That's like every Persianized household will have ispand. It's just a folk thing. It's wild rue seeds, and it's just like saging the house. So instead of saging, you just use wild rue. It has like a chocolatey scent, so I always love that scent. And then this wonderful pre-modern historian on sort of Islamic rituals and folk customs. She said that the isband actually has some kind of chemical that kind of cheers you up. So, of course, you'd feel positive.
Huh.
And you burn it, and it's like for New Year, you burn it, or you burn it at weddings, or, you know, to keep away the evil eye, to keep a place positive,
mm-hmm.
get rid of ghosts, you know, that kind of thing. When you buy a new house in Brooklyn, yeah. you always have to clear it out.
Yeah,
a lot of ghosts in Brooklyn.
Definitely. So many ghosts.
So, you know, and I think these rituals are really important. I like them. Mm-hmm. And that is one tether. And also, I think, you know, I have my language, which is a little sometimes infantile. My Persian is definitely, but my Uzbek is more grown up. But, you know, for me, thinking through it and being in, you know, as an academic, I research, write, and I do translate. I can't always write, but I can read, especially the Turkic is much easier for me. So I do translation as part of that. Being part of that community of writers and thinkers, that's a way to keep tethered, I think.
Yeah.
And tethered to something that's mercurial and changing and transforming, right?
Of course, yeah. And you said earlier that, you know, your memories, your culture is inside you, you know, that you don't necessarily need the heirlooms or the keepsakes. So, yeah, I have this question for you, but just as much for the people who are forced to leave now, often with very little on their backs. What for you has been the best way to preserve this culture as it is disintegrating in Afghanistan right now with the Taliban takeover?
Well, I think there's a lot of things to unpack in that question. When you leave a place, there is really no disintegration, I wouldn't say. Again, a culture is always changing. Even the Farsi language in Afghanistan has changed and moved and flexed to kind of include the different influences in the past 20 years. So I don't think anything is really calcified that disappears. I mean, of course, there are artifacts and ancient histories that the Taliban destroyed. Recently, the archway in Ghazni, that kind of destruction is alarming. That kind of disintegration is the destruction of like architectural, historical landmarks or monument type of things. Yes, they are doing that in certain areas, but I don't think it's strong enough to change the culture. I mean, look at Afghans, just the changing of a flag has made so many just regular everyday rural people resistors by bringing up the colors of, you know, black, red, and green. So I don't think it's something that gets erased in one generation. There are tragic losses to culture when the Taliban came. The last Afghan Sikh left and went to India. That was heartbreaking because now we've lost, you know, Afghanistan is an important place for Sikhism. There's Guru Nanak's important places that are there in Sultanpur. And then the fleeing of a lot of ethnic and religious minorities from Afghanistan, that's alarming because that's breaking up the fabric. I don't know if it's disintegrating, but it's tearing away at the foundational groups of Afghanistan, Afghan Sikhs, Hazara, Uzbek, Shia communities. So when that happens, that's destructive. But I don't know if it's so it's easy to say disintegration. I think a culture, the Afghan culture, is strong enough to withstand a lot of things. We're cultural preservers. I mean, I just think the culture moves on. It's an ancient region. It's like 5,000 years old.
Yeah.
There's coins I have from my great-great-grandmother on my other side, and it goes all the way back to Ardashir the First, who is a Sasanian king. This is 200-something BC.
Wow.
But the Ardashir coins, I think, are after during his son's period. So just in the things that we have that were like lucky charms and things that we kept, in that we have so much history of that region, Central Asia, Balkh, Khorasan, Afghanistan, Baghdad, whatever those areas were, they're all there. The traces are all there. So I don't think it's so easy to disintegrate Afghan culture. Afghan culture isn't just like 20 years or 40 years when They have all those pictures of women in miniskirts as that shining time of Afghanistan. That's not it. It's much older culture, tradition, people, way of being that doesn't get wiped away so easily.
And how do you tap into that very old vein when you're writing?
Well, I think that oral history is important, the oral tradition of poetry, poetry games. These things are ways we carry, when you can't carry books out, that's a way you carry out the soul of a place, right? Memorize poems. I think my dad has, and this is true for a lot of Afghan and Central Asian dads, they always, and moms, they come out with like a poem for each situation.
That's amazing.
That's pretty incredible. So, yeah. You know, proverbs and fairy tales and just stories and memory sharing and music. There's a strong musical tradition. I mean, I didn't grow up with a musical tradition, but others have, you know, my friends' parents have, you know, some musical talent and they play and they come together around that. So I think those cultural things, poetry, music, and stories.
And is there a story or a proverb that you feel particularly connected to?
Right now, the only thing I've been saying a lot is Deirayat, Khubayat. I keep saying that because everyone keeps missing the flights and the things, and there's so much waiting, and everyone's. So that means if it comes late, it will come even better. So it's just helping me cope with a lot of the anxiety of like figuring out if the things we say are helpful or harmful, or if the help we're doing is helpful or actually endangering people more. Like, you just don't know. So things like that, I think it's been helping to kind of say it as a mantra and to keep moving, right? Because I mean, when you're a migrant, you're flexible. When you're a migrant, there's a resiliency, there's a balancing, there's empathy, because you're almost, you know, you're learning and being connected to people you may not always connect with linguistically or culturally. So those are the traits of a migrant, I think.
Zora Said is a co-editor of the anthology One Story, 30 Stories, an anthology of contemporary Afghan-American literature. She's also the editor of Langston Hughes, Poems, Photos, and Notebooks from Turkestan, and she authored a bilingual poetry chapbook titled Misspelled Cities, Falsch geschrieben. Her essays on the Central Asian diaspora have appeared in Eating Asian America and the Asian American Literary Review, and she co-founded Upset Press with poet Robert Boras. Until very recently, Said was teaching at Bard, but 2 days before we talked, she accepted a position as distinguished lecturer at Macaulay Honors College. She lives in Queens, New York, with her family. To find out more, go to her website, Zora Said, that's ZohraSaed.com. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.